Welcome to Artist to Artist with Lisa Jacoby. Hey there, I'm Lisa. It's good to have you tuned in. My guest today is a musical artist who truly defies any superlative that my writer's pen efforts to relay. He is so extraordinary, and yet the humbleness of his presence underscores any superlative that one tries to endow on him. Now, when I first launched the Artist to Artist interview series, it was with the ideal of this artist in mind. It was Andy Stantman. I met Andy Stantman over 5 years ago, and albeit it was briefly, and he didn't remember me, but I met him at the International Mandolin Symposium in Santa Cruz, California. He was giving a workshop, and that workshop pretty much changed my entire approach to my own musicianship, whether I'm on mandolin, fiddle, my guitar, or upright bass. He was speaking and demonstrating the purity of notes on a mandolin. Now, most of us, when we hear mandolin, we know there's a bunch of notes, and they're played really fast most of the time. But not for Andy. He wanted to concentrate on one note. And anyone in attendance at that presentation, I would bet, came away from the entire week having gained more from Andy Stantman's inspirational and soul-revealing discussion about the quest to perfect one note isolated on one string until the edges of that note are smooth and the clarity of the tone rings out in perfect sound waves until that note determines it is complete. Now, it sounds so simple, and yet most musicians have never found that Avalon. I caught up with Andy backstage at the Barking Lake Theater in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It was just a few hours before he and his Andy Stantman trio would be getting underway with the show. Now, there's a sound check happening just beyond the curtains where we're sitting. A little noise there. Our conversation covered everything from his bluegrass mandolin playing and his jazz and klezmer clarinet artistry, as well as mandolin artistry, as well as his life as a master musician. And he's joined a few others in the mission of revitalizing forgotten ancient Hasidic music. And we talk about his religious and spiritual devotion that includes not touching any musical instruments on Friday after sundown. Now, most professional musicians would see this as bad for business, whereas Andy, well, he looks at it as honoring an important facet to a musical culture. Okay, let's get started with my artist-to-artist conversation with my idol, Andy Stantman.
First, thank you for being in the Artist Artist. Today is a couch.
Thanks for asking me.
It's kind of like, it's not like a psychologist or psychiatrist couch. It's a couch. It's a purple couch. So I think it has some.
That's nice.
It's got some good plum and energy happening. But I want you to talk to me about what does magic mean to you when it comes to musical artistry. What's your definition of magic?
It's interesting. I never thought of it in terms of magic. When you're playing music, it's sort of we all play music because it makes us feel good initially. I mean, that's really why people play music. You need to sort of keep that with you. You can get lost with studying theory, or get that lost with getting involved in technique, or getting involved in making a living in the music business, but you really need to keep in touch with why you're playing music, and of course, there's a payoff. It makes you feel good. It elevates you. It excites you. I don't think in terms of like, well, that was, you know, that performance was magic. Maybe it's a semantic thing I'm getting into here, but it's if you want the magic, you need to be able to create the situation around you that will enable those feelings to come out. Because generally what happens is when you reach a certain level as a musician, it's completely conversational. And you're just playing. You're not really, you know, you might, it's like in a conversation, but it's from another place. So it might be, if I'm talking to you, I might realize a point I want to make in the next 30 seconds, and I'm leading up to it. So if I'm playing, and pretty much everything I do is improvised, even if I'm playing a set melody, I'm improvising of how I phrase it and ornament it or do variations. So sometimes when you're playing music, you'll realize exactly how you're going to play everything. Mm-hmm. And other times, it just sort of happens. And what, you know, I'll get back to the word magic. What you're looking for is to be in a situation where the music just happens and you're not thinking about it.
Speaking to, it's just easy and it's coming. Do you sometimes feel like it's being channeled through you? Do you ever have those moments where just...
I mean, I've had moments where I was playing certain types of music where you almost go into a trance and you know, you see yourself going into this thing and then you wake up, so to speak, mm-hmm. and you finish playing what you were playing, you know, and as it's ending. So I've had those experiences with music, but it... You might be channeling, and that's a better word. It's really coming. Yeah. It's coming from you, from inside of you. As at least the way I see it, is a flow of energy and ideas and feelings being expressed through sound, but not verbal sound. So, but it's just like talking. It's really no different than talking. It's just another. It's an alternative way of using sound as a means of, maybe a non-specific communication, although it can be specific. But part of things is you have to really... the music needs to be set up to be able to give you that experience. Mm-hmm. So not all... You know, and you, there are a lot of different things that, you know, people experience. You know, so it's... You look at like Bill Monroe's repertoire, we had lots of different types of songs there that would express lots of different types of feelings. And some of it would be very deep, some of it would be very joyous, some of it would be, for lack of a better word, you know, maybe more superficial. But it just, you know, he looked for setups so he could express himself, so to speak. And I think that's what we all do when we're in music.
So you're living in Flatbush?
Yeah.
Are you in Midwoods?
Midwood, yeah. How do you know that area?
I've never been.
Okay.
But I'm a baseball fan.
Okay.
but I do know Flatbush is more like Caribbean and West Indies now. And
well, parts of Flatbush.
Yeah, and so are you in that scene at all, that music scene? Are you experiencing it?
I mean,
does it intrigue you at all?
Where I live there's a wild cultural mix there. It's a huge Orthodox Jewish neighborhood, mm-hmm. So that you have different brands of, you know, Hasidim and different brands of East European Jewry, but you also have, it's probably the outside of Israel, the largest Middle Eastern Jewish community in the world. So there are Jews there who, you know, background from Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, all over.
Right.
And all these cultures are happening simultaneously with a huge Russian population, Russian speaking, Ukrainian speaking population, Belarusian population. A huge Mexican population, mm-hmm. a huge multifaceted Caribbean population, and also a huge Pakistani population. So everything is, it's you know, you hear all these different things as you walk down the street.
It's got to be delicious.
It's great.
From a musician standpoint.
Yeah.
And do you pull themes out of the air as you're...
You know, New York always had so many, particularly in the 50s and 60s into the 70s, had so many great master ethnic musicians from different parts of the world who represented basically, you know, the height of certain indigenous regional styles, which are basically gone now. And but you still have great musicians and great, you know, there's all sorts of different types of Mexican music. I can hear all sorts of different types of Pakistani and Afghani music, you know, different types of Russian music. It's you know, different types of Jewish music. It's great. It's really great. I mean, around the corner from me, they have a whole ensemble where they teach what's called makam. It's a system of modal development. It's a type of classical music. It's the Syrian Jews, and they teach the kids oud and kanun and santur and violin. And it's like around the corner from me. I mean, there's all this stuff is just going on. So, you know, that's. But I think, you know, I think for most musicians, it was always like that. I think there's musicians usually weren't in a monolithic culture, and particularly if they were professional, they would be traveling around and hear other musical forms, and also probably be required to professionally play a number of different styles of music.
Yeah.
And what they would do is, you know, if once they, you know, they would master one style, and either they would then master another style or be able to play it passably, but be able to incorporate ideas from these second styles into the original style they were playing and make it sound like it was from part of, you know, that style. Mm-hmm. So it's great.
Is there any part of that musical menu that you haven't tasted yet that you feel like putting on your... incorporating into as you move forward? Is there something...
No, I mean, there... You know, when I was in my... 20s, I was studying with a number of different styles of music, and in the last year or so, I've thought of they've influenced everything I do, and I've thought of getting back into those styles. I've been in contact with some people who play these things. So,
anything in particular that you can share with our audience? That
you're no, playing? No. One is there's an area that's called Azerbaijan, which is sort of between Persia, or Iran, as they call it today, and Turkey, and they have the most amazing form of classical music, mm-hmm. and folk dance music, classical music, and expressive music. Had a great influence on my mandolin playing, my clarinet playing, and another thing is a type of music from an area called Ypres, mm-hmm. which was an area by the... it's sort of northwestern Greece by the Albanian border.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really super expressive, deep type of music. You know, clarinet and violin are very big in that. So I've been getting back into that, you know, as well. But, you know, but I've also been, you know, relearning Bill Monroe solos and, you know. Relearning a bunch of solos I learned from Charlie Parker and Lester Young and things. There's a lot I do. So
it's not enough hours in the day, years
right,
of life.
Right.
Doesn't it feel
right.
like it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
the chase is on now?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And sort of, you mentioned about around the corner and the students that are learning.
Yeah.
How about in your own Orthodox community?
Yeah.
It can be a tricky lifestyle. This is almost like two questions in one. Here you are. Most likely cannot be working and performing at sundown on Friday, which is a huge night for musicians.
Right, yeah.
But I know you've got to be playing music.
Yeah, sure.
But what from both a business standpoint and from a musical art?
I'm not playing music on Friday nights and Saturdays.
Okay. But it makes it tricky.
Where I pray, they come from... there was this thing in the early 18th century called the Hasidic movement. That, should I get into this now?
Yeah.
That started in Eastern Europe, and it was a movement that basically what happened was that the Jews were impoverished and horribly oppressed and murdered, and they're came to be a bit of a separation between the religious leaders, who were great scholars, and some of the masses. And the Hasidic movement basically came along, I'm just super simplifying, and said that basically, you know, we're in the eyes of God, we're all on the same level. We're all nothing compared to him, you know, and of course you need scholars, and the Hasidic leaders were equal scholars to these other scholars. But what they did was they... sort of reintroduced the use of music as a means of meditation and religious expression. And they developed melodies either very introspective or very joyous that were basically like spiritual workshops. And the melodies were set up to really induce a religious experience in you. And you can say, well, this, you know, what is this, some mystical or crazy, you know, like sounds. But, you know, you listen to Elvis, he induces an experience. You listen to Beethoven, you listen to Bill Monroe or Jesse McGrath, you know, they're all music you hear induces an experience in you. So they had melodies that were specifically set up to do this. So where I pray, they it's one particular group that's renowned for these melodies they write. And this group that composed thousands and thousands and thousands of melodies, there still is a core of people, mainly older, but still some young people, who are like guardians of this treasure of traditional melodies. And what I do is I'm involved in usually playing mandolin, sometimes clarinet with them, and recording these melodies, you know, professionally in right. studios and producing records and, you know, hoping to try and preserve this legacy. Because, you know, I've come to realize music is really of a time and place, and that you know, it reflects a certain feeling of a time and place. And then it's gone, and you have people who become guardians of that tradition, and they help keep it alive. But on the other hand, you know, any style is really based on the innovations of individual musicians who came out of a tradition and, you know, reinterpret it their own way, and you know, and then that becomes codified. And but so you have that. You know, like you have, like in New York City, you have a traditional jazz scene of you know, the people who play music from the 20s.
We all have a master that we tip our hat to, and sometimes we need to tip a lot more than just one. But if you had one master that you could tip to, who would you point at?
Oh, gosh. I've been really fortunate. I've been able to, you know, study with a lot of different people. I'll say this, which is right in the ballpark here, is that, you know, I got into bluegrass when I was about 12, 13.
Right.
And I played some guitar, and then I was into the banjo, and then I really got into the mandolin. And I have a brother who's about 8 years older than me. He had a jug band, and they used to play what they used to call hoots, hootenannies. So I used to go see him play, and there'd always be a bluegrass band. And I saw this band called the Garrett Mountain Boys, which was, in the band was Gene Loewinger and Steve Mandel and Jody Steck and David Grisman. And anyway, to cut to the quick, I became fascinated with the mandolin, and there were one or two mandolin solos that I had heard. I think one was by Earl Taylor, and one was maybe by B. Lilly. One was on the one of Earl Scruggs' blues songs. I forgot what the name is, and the other was something Earl Taylor did. Anyway. So I wanted to get the mandolin. It really gave me the chills. And I had seen David, and I called up David. And, David was like, you know, my primary teacher, because he really, first of all, he turned me on to Bill Monroe, because I'd been listening to him, you know, and that was a lesson in aesthetics. And he, turned me on to the whole thing of just slowing down records and learning note for note what happened, and to be fanatical about it. And if Bill Monroe did 7 tremolo strokes rather than 6, you do the 7, and then you begin to understand that, you know, it really does make a difference. You know, he was just improvising. He felt it, but there's a different feeling between the 6 and the 7 if you were tuned to it. I took about 5 lessons from David about the course of 2 years, and after that we just became, you know, colleagues and friends. And but he was the one who really, you know, got me started. Without him, I don't think I could have done anything. So,
well, Andy, I want to thank you.
I hope it wasn't too long-winded here.
But, no, Aaron, you know. It was a beautiful time sitting on the purple couch here at the back of the Barking Lakes Theater. I'm coming back for the show. I'm going to go get a bite to eat.
Okay,
And we'll see.
I want to thank all of you for joining me today in my artist-to-artist conversation with musical artist Andy Statman. Now, I urge you to visit Andy's website at andystatman.org, that's org, not .com, and look over his tour schedule to see when he might be playing at a stage near you. And also, you might want to gather up some of his music there. There's quite a range to be found, and I think you will enjoy it. For new listeners to the Artist to Artist series, I write a companion thought piece column for each of these interviews, and you can find them at bluegrasstoday.com or over at the Artist to Artist website itself. That's at lisajacoby.com, and that's Jacoby with an I. And I love growing the audience pie. So if you have a friend or a colleague who you feel might gain inspiration from these interviews, well, they're a great listen while making dinner. So please share it with them. And as always, thanks for taking it in. I'm going to take you out now with the Andy Statman Trio. This is a recent live performance of the tune Bluegrass Stomp. And now go out there and play nice on the planet.